This episode is brought to you by Vertera Dinnerware. Learn more at vertera.com. That's V-E-R-T-E-R-R-A.com.
Hello and welcome to Why Food, a podcast about entrepreneurs, innovators, and career changers in the food industry. I'm your co-host, Ethan Frisch.
And I'm your co-host, Valerie Lomas.
And this week we're talking to somebody a little different from our usual guest, somebody who works in a different aspect of the food world, but whose work is really interesting and important, and I'm really excited to share it with you. His name is Lauren Cardelli, and he is the founder of A Growing Culture. Lauren, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Ethan and Val.
So, Lauren, tell us, what is A Growing Culture, and how did you come to found the organization?
A Growing Culture is an organization dedicated to a just food system. We work with farmers, indigenous, and peasant groups around the world that are at the front lines of the food sovereignty movement or reshaping a food system towards one that is not only sustainable, but equitable.
And how did you get into that work?
It's a hard question because you always want to wonder, like, how far back do you want to trace, in your life story? But I would say that I grew up in New York and existed in that kind of typical suburban ecosystem back then, which was either jocks or punks, didn't really find a fitting there. And I went to a small school in Vermont for the last 2 years of high school, where I started milking cows at 5 a.m. and explored the environmental justice and movement and really connected. I decided to not go to college right off the bat. I had no interest. I hated the classroom mentality. So at the age of 18, I bought a one-way ticket to Latin America and I started traveling without an itinerary or schedule or return ticket. I met up with activists and farmers and worked on their farms, learned from them. This was kind of like before much of the wolf infrastructure, I guess. And also before like Facebook and things. And so I had met this guy in a bar in Belize who promised to teach me Bush Life 101. And I had no idea what that was. You have an idea, but my world was definitely blown up. That night, we jumped in the back of a pickup truck and we drove 3 hours into the bush. Now, if you understand anything about Belize, you know that during the occupation, England occupation, in what was called British Honduras, Spanish was outlawed. So you have a tremendous amount of English used in the country. And where we went from highway to gravel road to dirt road to logging road. And we got to this little community that only spoke Spanish. So then all the years of British occupation, they hadn't gotten this far into the bush. From there, that night, we hiked 2 hours into a slash and burn camp where I lived for multiple months and I drank from the same stream that I bathed and washed my clothes in. And we grew all of our own vegetables, hunted all of our own meat, and built our own homesteading. And it was unbelievable the amount of experience that I learned there with two local indigenous Belizeans. So basically what I realized was that we are better at growing food than I was hunting. And growing up, my father's Puerto Rican, we had a strong relationship with meat. and I had gone weeks and I was just kind of craving it. So there was a chicken farmer in the village, which was 2 hours walk. So I went to the chicken farmer to barter for some poultry that we'd bring back and cook. And what happened was, while I was bartering, I heard some screaming. And as I went over there, ran over there with the machete, feeling like I could solve anything at 18 years old, I saw a young man about my age today holding his son in his arms. His son's body was limp and pale, and his son had drinking the pesticides that his father used on the farm. The community was running up and surrounding this man, and it was a sight that has stuck with me till this day. What I realized there was that there are two sides of our agricultural system. There's the side of corporate monopolies, of extraction and exploitation, which go hand in hand. And there's a side of regeneration and healing, of peasant-led food systems based on indigenous and local knowledge. And I couldn't understand how we were so close, but yet so far away from that community. We were growing sustainably. We had surplus to bring to the market. We were basing our practices on just local and indigenous knowledge that was so incredible. But yet this community, because they were on a logging road, they were connected to the conventional commercial market. They had middlemen bringing them in chemicals, pesticides. And what I realized at that moment was the gateway to environmental erosion is social erosion, is the destruction of the social fabrics within our food system. And that led to the birth of the idea around a growing culture, an organization that supports peasant and indigenous and smallholder farmers around the world to reshape the food system as they see fit. Because agriculture, as we know it, is a 10,000-year-old journey of the exploitation of the very ones who grow our food. And agriculture is that double-edged sword. It's that tool of extraction and exploitation, or that tool of healing. But we've never seen what a regenerative and sustainable food system looks like, because we've always had a model that exploits the ones who grow our food. So it's up to us right now to shape that and to create that system that has farmers with a seat at the table.
What does that system look like? Or do you have a sort of a vision that you and the networks of farmers that you're working with around the world are moving towards together? Or is it all over the place? Everybody has their own vision. Where does it all coalesce?
Well, I think, this is a great question, Ethan. And the challenge is there's so much context, right? There's so much nuance to place. And that communities around the world are organizing for their right to exist and shape a food system that works for their communities. That looks very different for the ranchers of the Midwest to sub-Saharan smallholder farmers in Kenya and Tanzania. However, in principle, it looks like a system where farmers get a fair wage for their product, where farmers are treated with respect, where farmers can grow in dignity, and where industrial agriculture isn't shaping the very policies that are threatening the existence of the ones who grow our food.
Do you how have you met the networks of farmers who you're whose work you're profiling in your weekly series, and what do those relationships look like? What do they look to you for, and how do you support and learn from them?
Well, there's this story that I love to tell, which is a story about a journalist being sent to follow Cesar Chavez for a few days. And I think it was sent from the New York Times, if I'm correct. But she was sent out and traveled with Cesar Chavez from rally to rally for a few days. And then after a few days, she came up to Cesar and said, Caesar, how do you explain that inherent respect that these farm workers have for you? And of course he smiled and chuckled and he responded, the feeling is mutual. Like, that is a powerful story because it's a reminder of what and how we need to engage with these communities. To cultivate respect, you must treat others with respect. The challenge is far too often in the food movement, quote unquote, it's about consumer privilege. It's about self-benefit and self-health, where individuals care more about the food on their plate than the people who put it there. They care more about the way that farm animals were treated than the actual workers on those plants. And so we exist as an organization for the last 10 years, though underfunded and understaffed and under resources, we still have been building this network of integrity and respect for the ones who grow our food. And we stand for them in times when no others don't. So our programs are very different, but from place to place. But what our programs are rooted on is that we need to support the communities who know what best to shape their food system. And they're the ones developing models that are not only ecological, but are socially just. Like, otherwise you get a system where over 75% of the world's chocolate is grown in West Africa, but yet West Africa receives less than 2% of the $100 billion revenue. Like, I don't care if those farms are organic, they're still getting exploited. And that system has to change.
Yeah, that's first of all, thank you for sharing that story of how you witnessed this father mourning his son and that tragic death. And I think that the point that you're bringing up about, you know, when we look at different societies that have been colonized and subsequently exploited, and how that food ends up on our plates, and what is our role in all of this. And I think these are just things that a lot of American consumers, we just don't think about. And, you know, I was reading an article in Heated this week. It was written by Alicia Kennedy, and it was actually about the cost of chocolate, the cost of coffee, versus like the cost of truffles and the cost of wine, and how some are very highly valued, and other things like chocolate, which even though it should be highly valued, it isn't, simply because it comes from a place where it has been colonized, and subsequently the farmers have been exploited, if paid at all. So I think that these are just like issues that we don't always think about. So how can, like, what does like the average consumer need to ask themselves, or what does the average consumer need to do to kind of be a part of us all doing better in this system?
Yeah, I mean, it's so challenging, right? Because when you walk through Whole Foods, which is supposed to be an ecosystem which presents, you know, righteous food shopping and opportunities, it's probably about 1% of those companies know who their farmers are.
Yeah.
Right? Like, it's a shame how few companies know their actual farmers. So I think one thing that consumers can do is to demand that those connections are made and existence. Like, you know, you look through social media and you look at brand after brand, they're celebrating the recipes and the food porn pictures that they put up. But how often are they celebrating the ones who grow their food, right? And they're all getting the products from the same damn organic distributors. Like, they're all getting their products. So every food company is basically just a repackager. And it should be, every food company is a cultivator of relationships and partnerships. And so it's up to consumers to demand that, to put pressure on these companies to humanize their products, to tell the deeper story. And that's something that our organization is trying to do in partnership with, you know, sustainable and ethical food companies. it's up to consumers to demand that, because, you know, but there's also like, there's a need. Like we frame farmers as these helpless beneficiaries rather than like active innovators. We frame, you know, farmers as like deserving of charity. Like, I don't want to curse, but I do, but you know, like the, like that's ridiculous. Like they need parity. Right. And so when we look at conferences and we talk about a global food system and that panel is filled with white researchers and chefs, what are we saying about the food system? When we have that one token farmer there that's being framed as a beneficiary of a technological assistance, what are we framing our food system on? What are we framing our food system when we're centering on white voices, when 95% of our global food is produced by people of color, right? Like there's just like this siloing that's done. And I have to say that like the consumer mindset has only entrenched that. And we have to break that. Like if you're not hungry, you're benefiting from somebody who is. And it's up to all of us to hunger for that justice.
Yeah. Why? I mean, some of this is obvious and connected to histories of colonialism, but why do you think there is such a resistance among both consumers and food brands to explore and talk about where their food comes from, that it's so much easier to talk about the, I mean, as you mentioned earlier, the health and happiness of an animal or the organic status or, you know, other elements of the environment that are being cared for. But talking about people is challenging, I guess, and really very rarely done in the same way. So why do you think that is?
Mm. Well, I love that question. I've been thinking about this a lot. It keeps me up at night, you know. I think it is protectionism. I think, you know, we're so fucking fragile. Like we want to protect ourselves so much and we want to feel empowered that we're doing good. And so when we look at our food system as an environmental science, as an environmental act, it removes the social implications, right? And then we can have this reductionist view and say, I care about soil carbon. I care about the earthworms. I care about the little pigs. I care about, you know, these pollution. But what that does is it prevents us from holding up a mirror. Because like, if you want to know what would change the food system, that innovation already exists and it is a mirror. It's up to all of us to look inwards and to see how we are complacent at the very injustice that our food system is. And I think like, we don't want to see that. We don't want to confront our own privilege and benefit. I mean, for the largest economic study of inflows and outflows into the African continent was done by Jason Hickel. He wrote about it in The Divide. And it showed that for every dollar of aid gone into the African continent, $24 is taken out. And that's all of USAID. That's all of Bill and Melinda Gates. That's all of the European Union's foundations and charity. I mean, that's the system we live in. People don't want to understand that because every time they take a bite of an ingredient, it has to come with a trigger warning. Like, that's the reality of the system. Like, and in the United States, like, I can't tell you how many times I talk to funders or media and they say, oh, we'd love to report on this or we'd love to support this, but we're focusing on domestic issues. You know what? That's a damn privilege, because every group that we talk to around the world, every group that we're working with, America is in their narrative. America is in their story. For instance, every 4 days, a Filipino farmer is murdered. In the last week, two Filipino farmer activists were gunned down. 90% of Filipino farmers don't have access to land because of a feudal system that was set up by American occupation. The Korean Women's Peasant Association, or the UTT, who's the union of land workers in Argentina, who are featured on this Friday's broadcast, they're fighting the neoliberalist World Bank policies that America perpetuates on their communities that starve peasant populations. I mean, they're fighting that. They're addressing that. They can't say we are only talking about local. issues because that doesn't, they're not afforded that privilege.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
that kind of reminds me of the recent discourse surrounding the coronavirus, because, you know, it started off as something that was happening, quote unquote, over there to other people. And there was this false idea that, you know, we didn't have to worry about it. And I think that fiction has been shattered, at least in that specific instance. But I do think you're absolutely right. Does someone want to take a bite out of a chocolate bar with a trigger warning, or every time they have a cup of coffee in the morning, they realize the high cost of what it took for those coffee beans? It's like, that's not something that we're ready for right now.
I mean, or are we, right? Like that's the reality, is that, like, there's probably a 60 or 70% chance, if you're biting a bite out of chocolate, that chocolate was harvested using slave labor, right? Like, companies have been pressured time and again for the last 20, 30 years, and they have not been able to commit. No company of the major chocolate providers, right, has been able to commit to more than 50% of their chocolate comes from slave-free conditions, you know, and you have to wonder if they're even telling the truth when they say 50%.
Right.
Like, that's the reality. And it frustrates me time and again how protected that we want to be. It frustrates me how siloed America wants to sit in, right? It's like the reason for, like, we need to have global solidarity around these issues. Monsanto, Cargill, the big industrial corporations, they're not thinking locally. Like, they're thinking for global situations. Like Monsanto is writing policy that makes it illegal for farmers to sell or trade their seeds across Africa. Like, that's happening right now. And we're advocating against that. We're working with Seed Savers groups. You know, last fall, I was with a woman Seed Saver group in the north of Uganda, in Gulu. And this woman took me back to the behind her house, to this field where she was growing this beautiful groundnut, which is peanut, right? And she said that a Christian warlord named Joseph Kony terrorized northern Uganda. He was cutting off the noses, the ears, and the lips of people, killing women and men, using child soldiers. And the government could not control him. They could not catch him. So what they did was they moved Ugandans to internal displacement camps, which are basically refugee camps for people of origin. She got a moment's notice to leave her home. She had to grab her family's possessions and heirlooms. What she grabbed was that groundnut variety. She then, in a refugee camp for 20 years, cultivated that variety at the edge of the camp every year to keep it alive. It's illegal for her to sell that variety. That's because of American policy.
Yeah. On that note, we're going to take a quick break. Stay with us. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
This episode is brought to you by Vertera, impressively versatile, stylishly sustainable, environmentally disposable dinnerware from fallen leaves. Vertera is a mission-driven company focused on making environmentally responsible, single-use products. Founded in 2006 on the belief that every culinary creation deserves a beautiful, sustainably crafted foundation. Vertera reclaims earthly discards like fallen leaves and tree scraps to design elegant, disposable dinnerware that elevates the look of food presentation. In short, a beautiful, disposable plate that can go with your food to a composting facility. The team from Vertera recently made a huge pivot with their factories and started producing masks, gloves, sanitizer, and other PPE that food businesses need to safely reopen. Learn more at Vertera.com. That's V-E-R-T-E-R-R-A.com.
And we're back. You're listening to Why Food. Our guest this week is Lauren Cardelli, founder of A Growing Culture. Before the break, we were talking a little bit about the impact of American policies on farmers and farm workers around the world, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa. And Lauren, I wanted to pivot just slightly to talk about your experience in advocacy on these issues and the process of creating and building an organization that takes a stand. A lot of our listeners are early stage entrepreneurs or career changers or in search of their calling, their idea, their way to impact food systems for the better. So how has that experience been for you? How have you built an organization to work towards topics that you care about?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, it's been a challenge. 10 years I've been doing this. First 5-6 years it was self-funded. And we've been trying to raise support. We have a collective of activists and that work for the organization. Everybody is either a volunteer or an intern. There's no salaried staff because we've never been able to afford that. However, we do incredible work and we work with groups all around the world, and I cannot be more proud of the work that we're doing. And we do have a perception of a full staff team. Which is great, because that shows that the content and the work that we're doing is of that high caliber. It's challenging to build an organization. A lot of, I didn't want to just work. I'm not an academic. I didn't study development. I got a degree in agriculture, and I was working on farms before I founded this organization. I wasn't born into a rich and affluent family. I didn't have the ability to be bankrolled by family, and most organizations have that start. We didn't. We just thought of an idea and went after it. And that's kind of been the journey of AGC. In some ways, it's a strength because we're able to do what others can't with less resources. We're able to build the integrity and the network of a global movement. But it's hard because we can't afford the staffing that we need. So it's challenging, and that challenge comes from like the dynamic of how you tell your story, how you fundraise. You know, it's hard to get good at asking for money. It's also hard to create a pitch when so many times funders want to be empowered themselves, and we're not in the interest of empowering consumers. You know, and we're not in the interest of empowering farmers, and farmers empower us. And so, finding those taglines and those niches, right, that like allow you to raise money where people get excited about that is something we're working on as an organization. If any listeners have some feedback or advice, please reach out. We're looking for ways to decentralize funding or to decolonize philanthropy so that we can bring these funders into models of collaboration with grassroots groups. But it's, you know, I wouldn't really recommend to anybody to start an organization from scratch. It's challenging, but it's been the most exciting journey of my life, and I'm grateful for it. Advocacy work is something that is heart-wrenching and, you know, thrilling at the same time. We're dealing with groups that have had a really hard time, and the more you're there for them, the more you understand their lens, how they view the world. And that is hard sometimes. It's hard to understand how messed up this world is, you know. A number of the groups that we work with have been classified as, you know, extreme activists or terrorist groups because of authoritarian governments that don't want, you know, any kind of activism. And these are dangerous situations, you know. But I think what's really important is to create an organization that doesn't look at a panacea, that doesn't look like as a scalable solution where it's like a one size fits all. Because when we get a one size fits all mentality, what we're doing is further entrenching the very linear and extractive thinking that industrial agriculture was birthed out of. And so we're not looking as an organization to increase yield or to build wells, to say, you know, every $10,000 that you donate, two wells get built around the world. No, we're cultivating agency of the grassroots. We're connecting them in solidarity to reshape food systems. And that, like, de-objectification process is absolutely essential. And that's what we're doing with our farmers. And that's why we have trust and respect, and where other groups don't.
I mean, these issues, I think, are complicated and interesting for a lot of the same reasons, right? The agriculture is cross-cutting and involves everything from racism to misogyny to use of chemicals to commercialization. There's so many elements so many elements contained within this one subject, and then it spans every country in the world and every region of every country. There's so much diversity and complexity within the issues that you're tackling. How are you making decisions about where to spend your time and which issues to advocate on first, I guess?
Well, there's foundational issues that, you can jump on with seed. Seed is a powerful issue to take on. We work with a seed saver in India. Kind of to give you a little bit of context, in 1970, there was over 110,000 varieties of indigenous rice grown in India. Today, there's less than 6,000. It's a massive ecocide. Those rice varieties are called landraces, right? They hold the keys that we need to grow food on a changing climate, right? So the industrial agricultural response is the International Rice Research Institute, which is positioned in the Philippines. It was founded in 1960. And it gets about $100 million a year of funding. And it has about 1,000 scientists working to develop with corporations varieties of seeds that will allow the rice cultivation in the future. And the thing is this, is that not a single of those hybrid seeds that have been developed out-yield local and indigenous seeds. And we have that research that proves that. It's been documented in peer-reviewed journals. In extreme climatic conditions, not a single hybrid variety can outperform local and indigenous varieties. Monsanto teamed up with Erie some years ago and developed an iron-fortified variety, which was published throughout journals in the academic world. And they said that the highest amount of iron possible in rice was 9.8 milligrams per kg, right? 9.8 milligrams per kg. In our possession, in this seed conservation effort that we're supporting in India, we have over 20 varieties that have over 100 milligrams per kg of iron, right? But nobody cares because those varieties are backwards. They're developed by unnamed scientists, aka farmers of color, right? So nobody cares to do the research on those varieties to even create the counter narrative to disprove industrial agriculture and all of its feats, right? Like, we have varieties that grow in salt water. We have over 13 varieties that grow in salt water. Monsanto or Bill and Melinda Gates haven't developed that with their research. Like, the solutions to growing around the world aren't coming from Silicon Valley or Iowa or Cornell or Wall Street. They're coming from grassroots organizations and people of color around the world that are on the front lines of real change. And they've developed these varieties. And these varieties are under attack. And that's why these systemic laws are in place, because they know that their only competition in the industrial system are the proof and evidence that these varieties provide. So one of the big issues we do is seed work, because it's foundational and it's an ultimate powerful narrative around the industrial system. Another one we do is, we do a lot of human rights and looking at the intersectionality of gender, because, I know this is hard for a lot of people to maybe understand, but mitigating climate change has a lot more to do with gender equality than Elon Musk. And women produce a majority of the world's food. In some parts of Africa, it's 80 to 90% of the local food consumed is produced by women, right? However, 80% of climate change refugees are women. Like, women are leading the charge against creating the innovative solutions, but yet they're not heard of, they're not recognized, and they're not supported by the local financial institutions or the global narratives. So we work with that. We try to find, you know, these nodal points or these acupuncture points to actually challenge narratives and to disrupt the industrial agricultural system in a way that disproves the efficiency. I mean, and it's like crazy for me to even have to talk about or strategize how to prove the inefficiency, because smallholder farmers who are farming less than 5 hectares of land, right? They make up 94% of the world's farms. Yet they only control 19% of agricultural land. That's less than a fifth of the world's cultivated land. Yet they produce the calories for 70% of the world's population. Industrial ag, farming on 81% of the world's cultivated land, produce food for about 30% of the world's population. So are we talking about efficiency still? Because I don't understand how that narrative is even existent, that we need industrial ag to feed the world. Because right now, we produce enough food for almost 11 billion people, and in a population of 7.5 billion, 1.2 billion still go to bed hungry. That math does not work without injustice in the equation.
Yeah. And the systems that keep it in place are the same systems that tie back to the what you mentioned earlier about rice varieties grown by your partner in India and Monsanto's desire to have things that they can patent and sell and control rather than seeds that would spread through social networks or within communities freely and people would be able to use as they saw fit rather than as a corporation would want them.
Absolutely. I mean, and that's the reality of the situation is that, like, we talk about the very first seeds sown in the Neolithic Revolution 10,000 years ago. We talk about those seeds as seeds of wheat, but they weren't. They were seeds of patriarchy and hegemony. And those seeds cultivated have bear the fruit of the injustice that we live in today. And yeah, that's the world. It's the perfected patriarchy and hegemony that agriculture has created. And so I'm not in the business of romanticizing agriculture, which a lot of people do, right? I'm in the business of envisioning a future, a system based in equity and justice.
So what is, I mean, in the 8 minutes we have left to talk, what is that vision, or what's the path to that vision at the very least?
Right. And also, like, how, obviously we can't separate food injustice from injustice. So is there any workaround, or do we really just need to create a more just society overall?
Well, I mean, I think it's like, yeah, I don't think we can separate any of that, because I think it's all the same. Like, you know, agriculture, our shift to agriculture shaped society more than anything. And we live in a society that's, you know, a derivative of that. Right. So I think it's like, you know, let's talk about anything that's not related to food. I can't find a damn thing. Right. I think what's really important is to recognize is that, like, when you look at these, like, you know, you pick up a product at the grocery store and you see all these merits and certifications and badges, they're all environmental, you know, for the most part. You know, fair trade doesn't change too much dynamics, I'll tell you that. But yet, like, we have to pressure our participation in the system and from a human lens. Like, you know, like Caesar says, it's never about grapes or lettuce. It's always about the people. You know, there is a certification that was started in the United States called Agricultural Justice Certification. Not a single brand has that lined up with it. Not a single brand. Farmers have, but not a single brand, because it doesn't allow them to exist in the model that they want to exist in. And that's revealing. So it's up to us to challenge that, to look at models of equity sharing, of partnerships, of co-sponsoring, of investment into these communities, of fair pricing. And there are companies, you know, that are doing amazing work. you know, and I know Burlap and Barrel is one of them. And it's really crucial and important to recognize and to support those companies. And because like so many CEOs and entrepreneurs, and I'm sure they're listening to this show now, are getting into the food movement. They're getting into this, you know, ecological or sustainable industry because of the natural industry, because they want to change the food system. So change it through that social lens. Start there. Don't say we're going to do this environmental thing and our goal long term is to embed some equity sharing or something. No, start there. Because our relationship to the environment is a reflection of our relationship to society. We will not have sustainability as long as that injustice and patriarchy exist in our relationships amongst each other.
Yeah, thank you. Yes. No, it's great. I'm trying to figure out a graceful way to pivot to our like fun rapid fire segment, and there isn't really, so I'm just going to stumble.
Let's just do it.
Right, exactly. So let's talk a little bit about, or Valerie, was there anything else you want to talk about before we move on?
No, I'm listening and learning.
All right, so let's start with Lauren. Tell us about a meal that you had on one of your travels somewhere. A meal that really stands out to you in your memory.
Well, there's like, I've had some like really crazy meals, and when you watch these like shows on TV and they eat these like quote unquote strange things, I'm always like, what? That's not that strange. You know, when you work with peasant communities, you eat peasant food, and peasant food is the best food. But there's a meal that I tend to wake up thinking about sometimes. It's so weird to even say that. But like, I crave this meal called bún cha, and it's a Vietnamese soup. It's incredible with bún noodles and barbecued pork. And I had this spot, was I lived in Vietnam for a couple of years working with groups. And I had this spot that I used to love to go to. This woman I used to call mother. She used to feed me. And the last time I went there was a long line because Anthony Bourdain took Obama there, and now it's famous. So I'm a little disappointed I have to compete with people to go there, but I'm really glad for her business. It's the best soup of the world. And I'm not a soup person, so I love that. And, you know, I'm also like a big fried fish. When I'm in Africa, we always go to the docks and eat fried fish. It's incredible.
Yeah. Valerie?
How about, I mean, this is tough because I feel like these questions can't be trivial. Let's say, I always like to ask about fruits and vegetables. So maybe like what's a vegetable that like, or a fruit that you discovered that like you can kind of describe to us that we may not know about yet? Because I feel like describing like fruit that isn't necessarily like something that we're familiar with is something that happens in media, and people often get it a little, I don't want to say wrong, but you know, we tend to focus on the things that make that fruit maybe appear strange or unappetizing to us. So I would just like to hear you describe something.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. You know, I really love bitter foods, right? And there's that like bitterness that like so much of us, I mean, I'm like laughing inside because it's like the talk we just had. Of course, I would say I like bitter shit, but I apologize for being predictable there. But like,
I love it.
But like bitter food is really incredible. And like the most healthy food is bitter, but also the most poisonous. And so it takes a lot of local and indigenous knowledge to understand what is good, because like part of that defense mechanism to protect ourselves over generations was to be avoidant of the bitter taste, right? But like, on the flip side is it's some of the most healthy foods. And so when you eat these bitter herbs, like, I mean, like, guys, what is a bitter food that we eat in America? Like, what is that? I mean, horseradish, I guess?
Endives.
Endives, okay, yeah.
Anything else you think? IPAs.
IPAs, okay, well, yeah, boom. An IPA was developed to protect, you know, and preserve the beer from infection over the seas. So the, yeah, bitter. I love bitter vegetables, and all these societies that we work in, they just full on embrace bitter food. And it's incredible to see that, because like, you know, I've had bitter drinks and bitter foods that like, you know, would take what the, you know, an IPA or an endive or, or the horseradish and just multiply that by like 100 easily. That like your face when you drink that juice is just like repugnant. Like, oh, but it's like you get used to it. You train yourself the same way a lot of these like hipsters had to train themselves to drink IPA before it was so trendy, right? Like you have to, you condition yourself and then you start to crave it. And it's fascinating because like I love eating something that bites back. Like I love chilies and anything. I love it. It's like how you use it in your spicing and cooking. It's like you can use a little bit, but you know what? It's going to let you know that it's there. I like that.
That's awesome. My turn. One more.
Sure.
What do you like to cook? What are some of your go-to recipes when you're cooking at home?
Well, I mean, I have to say I'm not a vegan, so I tend to shape my foods around meat. I love meat, and I love cooking rabbit stew. Sorry for anybody who's cringing about that. I do love cooking snails. I go to Chinatown and I pick up snails and I do like a, you know, lemongrass and chili or some kind of snail dishes. I enjoy that tremendously. I do a lot of Asian noodle dishes because my partner is just like a lover of everything noodle. So, I try to get on her good side by feeding a lot of noodles. And we do a lot of like Asian noodle dishes. And I tend personally, I'm not as big of a soup fan. I know I said my favorite dish was soup. So I tend to do a lot of more like stir fried noodles, which I really enjoy.
Those sound good maybe a little more challenging to find the ingredients than most of the answers we get to that question. So I appreciate the rabbits and the snails deserve our culinary love too.
Absolutely. I mean, I get to bring home spices and stuff from when I travel. Yeah. So I do have a nice collection.
I know how that goes. Yeah. It's a good way to do it.
We can relate on that, right?
Right. Well, Lauren, it's been such a pleasure having you on this week. Where can our listeners see your weekly series? Where can they learn more about your work? Follow you on social media?
Yeah, go to grownculture.org. Go to follow Grown Culture on all of the social media platforms except for TikTok. We are here for you. And also email Lauren@grownculture. You know, reach out. We're a movement. We want to learn. We want to listen. And we want to engage, and we're really trying to figure out a way to solve the major problems of our time, you know?
Yeah. And I realize we've mentioned this, but we haven't really explained it. Could you just briefly talk about the weekly video series that you're doing on Friday?
Oh, yeah. So like, you know, COVID had this way of like peeling the layers of the proverbial agricultural onion to like really expose the injustices in our food system. And like COVID is this, you know, global pandemic. It's the first time where like all of us can be feeling something together. When I talk to farmers in Uganda, Zimbabwe, you know, Palestine or Philippines, we're all confronted with this pandemic. And so what we wanted to do was to start a weekly live broadcast. It's a webinar. It's live streamed on Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter, as well as on our Zoom platform. And every week is another story of resilience and brilliance of the grassroots around the world. This week we have Argentina group, UTT. We have groups from the Puerto Rico, from Papua New Guinea, from Zimbabwe, from Nicaragua to Ukraine to, you know, black food justice groups in the United States, to indigenous groups all around the world. I mean, this is like what we're trying to do is to elevate and amplify the stories that aren't heard across the food media space, because our liberation is tied to theirs. So let's get on this together.
All right. I love it. As always, you can reach us by email, yfood@heritageradionetwork.org. You can reach me via my spice company, Burlap and Barrel, @BurlapandBarrel on Instagram.
You can follow me on social media @foodieinnewyork.
Thanks to Jess Krangich, our amazing sound engineer. Thanks to the Red Crickets for our theme song, Blind. And most of all, Lauren, thank you. Thank you for sharing your wisdom, your passion, your knowledge, your everything else. Has been one of my favorite interviews maybe we've ever done on this podcast. So I really appreciate it. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Ethan and Val. Thank you, guys. I appreciate that. I'm sorry. I've had a few of these espresso shots today, so I'm a little amped.
It was great. Every word was important, and I'm glad we can help share the knowledge that you've built over the last 10 years.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that.
Thanks, everybody. See you next week.
Why Food is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork.
Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.